Do you want me to do the intro?
No, I'm doing the intro.
All right, good.
I just misread a word.
Hey, it's fine. You keep.
Actually, just, I just omitted a word.
What?
I omitted a word.
Look, just do it. We're going to be here for fucking ever.
Shut up. I'm already hysterical. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott. Sitting to my right is your co-host, Ian Mond.
Hi, Kirsten.
Hi, Ian.
What are we doing today, Kirsten?
Well, one of us, who shall remain nameless, had an idea a while ago.
Yeah, earlier in the year when we were still bright and cheery.
Yeah.
Hadn't been hit by, you know, the year. And you had this idea. It sounded great, this idea.
The year hit hard.
It did. It has hit hard. And your idea was that we get a feel for the ebook, self-published ebook market out there.
Yes. So we asked listeners for recommendations of ebooks.
Yes.
Because we didn't want to just go in blind.
No. That would have been worse than what the experience actually was.
Stop it.
Spoilers.
Stop it.
Yeah.
And we got some recommendations, and I didn't go back and re-listen to that old podcast. I probably should have. I believe we were offering to send books to people who recommended a book that if we liked the book they recommended, we would send them a book.
Oh, so we had to actually like the book.
Oh, yeah.
We won't be sending many books then. Spoilers!
We didn't not like all of them.
No, well, we'll get there.
And we didn't even not like all of them. If that makes sense.
No. I just want to say up front that we're not doing this in one podcast.
No.
We made that decision last.
There are six books.
Yes. We actually made that decision on the last podcast.
We did.
And we confirmed it post the podcast. And so we're doing three this month and three next month.
And three next month.
Actually, we're just doing them all tonight. But for you guys, it'll be broken up. You didn't want me to tell people that we're doing six books tonight, and I'll be here till 4 a.m.
No, I don't care. You can tell them that.
Okay. Well,
we just thought it'd be nicer for people to not have a 4-hour podcast.
Yes,
that's what we thought.
And I'll just say this: Paintwork is the last book we're talking about, possibly at 2 a.m. So, Tim, mate, who knows what we'll be saying by then?
We'll be very punch drunk, I think.
Yes. But I think the main reason why we're splitting it is because we didn't want to just spend 5 minutes on each book.
No.
We wanted to treat them like proper books, like we would treat our other books.
Yes.
And not give them short shrift. To be fair, we wanted to be genuinely constructive in our criticism, although we may not actually end up. Yeah, we wanted to be being, you know, an aspirational comment rather than.
Oh, no, I intend to be constructive.
Yes. So look, we'll probably spend 20 minutes on each book as it works out, or 25 minutes. So, yeah.
So there'll be no rambling at the beginning.
No, that was the rambling.
That was the rambling.
So should we get started?
I think we should get started.
Otherwise, my wife and kid will never see me again. So the first one we're doing is Angel Fall. Now, I've checked the Goodreads.
By Susan E.
Oh, by Susan E.
I should say.
Yes, sorry.
Which was recommended to us by Jonathan Strahan.
Yes. Now, to be fair to Jonathan.
Oh, no. I'm not going to be fair to Jonathan.
Well, I don't believe he's read Angel Fall.
Then he should not have recommended it.
No, and recommended is a loose term. I think he just was giving us an idea of a self-published book he was aware of in his role as the editor of reviews at Locus and thought we might be interested in looking at it. But I don't think he was saying, I've read this. It's the ant's pants. Mate, drop everything. Read this now. Fuck the podcast. Just read the book. I don't think that was what Jonathan was saying. And I would ask Jonathan to now go read Angel Fall.
I think he has to.
Yes.
I think he owes that to us to read Angel Fall.
Absolutely part of the punishment. So, yes, that's right. We didn't actually like this book. Spoilers. But I will say, I went to Goodreads and I checked the ratings on Goodreads of each book. Obviously, you don't have to review each book, but you can give a 5-star rating.
Yep.
And what the average rating is for each book. Angel Fall easily outstrips every other book we'll be talking about over the next 6 months. Angel Fall has 8,943 ratings as of October the 18th, 2012.
Is it a lot?
Well,
I don't go on Goodreads all that often. Is that like an above average number of reviews?
I actually didn't check. I didn't. I, unfortunately, I didn't do that. I didn't check it against other books. I've only checked it against the ones that we're doing, and compared to the ones we're doing, it is far outstrips. And I would argue that it probably is a very high number. And the amazing thing is,
because it's only been out for about a year.
It's a year, just a year. Yeah, May 2011, I think it was released. And its ratings, its average rating, is 4.35 out of 5. So just absorb that for a second. Now, I know some of you may not have read the book, but 4.35 out of 5 means, on the bell curve, that a lot of people have given this book 5 out of 5.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
If you go onto Goodreads and read the reviews, and I dare you to, you will find, I mean, if you ever wanted to define the word squee.
Well, actually.
And not to knock the people reviews, but there's a lot of love for this book, a huge amount of love.
Well, actually, I found a sampling of them, and all 5-star reviews was this sample, and things like the story is original and suspenseful and terrifying. He's a wonderful, gut-wrenching author. Couldn't put it down. Sexy, scary, and unpredictable. Really, really.
Yeah, if you go by the
happy,
if you go by
best book of the year,
I just had a check, by the way, at Stephen King, Shining has 316,000 ratings. So
okay,
yeah, so a popular author, and with the average rating, The Shining, of 3.96. So she's not at Stephen King's level. And I'm not going to go through here checking mid-list authors to see how she compares. But but as you quoted out, this is a popular book.
Yes.
And people are gagging, kvetching. No, kvetching is not the right Yiddish word. Chalashing. Chalashing is the right Yiddish word for the second book to come out. And I believe there's going to be 5 in the series.
I had a quick check of the author's website, and she said she was guessing there would be 5.
Guessing. Well, there you go. So what is this book, Angel Fall, about? The title's a giveaway.
Well, I can read the blurby thing that's...
Please do.
Okay. It's been 6 weeks since angels of the apocalypse descended to demolish the modern world. Street gangs rule the day while fear and superstition rule the night. When warrior angels fly away with a helpless little girl, her 17-year-old sister Penryn will do anything to get her back. Anything, including making a deal with an enemy angel. Rafe is a warrior who lies broken and wingless on the street. After eons of fighting his own battles, he finds himself being rescued from a desperate situation by a half-starved teenage girl. Travelling through a dark and twisted northern California, they have only each other to rely on for survival. Together they journey toward the angel's stronghold in San Francisco, where she'll risk everything to rescue her sister, and he'll put himself at the mercy of his greatest enemies for the chance to be made whole again.
Yeah, that sounds... Yeah, whatever.
So they're off to see the wizard.
Yeah, off to, basically, yeah. Do you buy the 6 weeks?
Fuck no. Can I just say that from the beginning, that just kept ringing in my head like this cracked bell. Like every reference that was made to, oh, before this began, or, oh, back, you know, before the day when Gabrielle was killed, all of that, like this little bell would go in my head, go, what, before 6 weeks?
Yeah, exactly, because it makes out in the book, it's years ago. This has been the state
of
play.
Well, no, it doesn't make out.
It doesn't say it.
It says over and over it's 6 weeks, but it feels like it's something that should be years ago.
Yeah, and you think, it was just a month and a half ago.
I mean, you've got all these different sort of broken down human societies or proto societies and survival groups and gangs and everything forming. You've got cannibalism. Why is it I've got no baked beans in the cupboard. Oh no, I need to eat someone.
It's so true. I don't mind the idea that the angels came and literally wiped out armies
and
governments. I don't have a problem.
But
the fact that a resistance movement has been set up pretty decently, that they can actually do what they do in the later part of the book in 6 weeks.
It feels like something that the apocalypse happened, you know, at least months, if not years ago. That's what it feels.
I'm glad I can
In part, because in other parts it doesn't. In other parts they're still wandering around and finding food in people's houses and, you know, they've only just been forced to leave their own house, Penryn and her mother and her sister, when the book starts. So in some ways it can only be a few weeks. But then that completely undermines the world building of the entire book if it's only 6 weeks. It's just, and then, like I said, like all the way through it's like 6 weeks. Really? 6 weeks? Oh, you're doing the whole cannibalism thing. What, you ran out of Cheetos? I don't understand. Surely there's still some beef jerky lying around the place.
And also, you know, would you, I mean, they wouldn't have run, okay, they would have run out of food, but I also got the feeling.
What, in 6 weeks?
Not, well, I don't know what has happened to
Penryn. You mean Penryn?
Yeah, Penryn.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But the,
yeah.
I also got this impression that she was at subsistence level and she was fucked and starving.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They had a little chocolate bars left and they were literally dying. It's a month and a half ago. It doesn't make sense. The criticism to us will be, but don't you know if our modern world does collapse, we're all fucked. Well, first off, maybe, but you're right. Cannibalism within 15 minutes of something, of the shit hitting the fan, even if it was angels coming down to fuck us all.
Yeah.
I didn't buy it either. That's just point. So willing suspension of disbelief?
Yeah, not so
zero.
Much.
Zero.
Not yeah. so much.
Okay, so that's shitty point one. I'll tell you something I did like. I like the fact it was set in Silicon Valley because I thought that's interesting and different, and I wonder if she'll make something of the fact that it's set in the technological heart of the world because, you know, science versus supernatural, you know? No.
Not so much.
It's just based
they
in Silicon
out
Valley.
Into the forest.
Yeah, they were in the forest. I thought there would have been this nice juxtaposition between the sort of supernaturally aspect of the angels and that sciencey geek aspect, but no, there isn't. So it could have been set anywhere in America. It could have been set in
It really could, and I don't know. The world building, it was just completely off kilter for me. I could not buy that world at all. I couldn't buy it on a time sense. It just didn't make any sense at all.
Yeah. I like the fact that the mum was a bit crazy because she was off her meds. That was okay. Mm. And I like the fact that her sister, Penryn, the main character's sister, is in a wheelchair and has had an accident of some sort, which is never – is that explained? Because I don't remember it being explained. Something to do with the father and who's dead.
Yeah. When she was little, it didn't happen because of the apocalypse.
Yes, to be honest.
Anyway, she's been in a wheelchair.
The reason
for
I'm not 100% sure is the reason I'm annoyed by this book, in that this is an interesting opportunity to have this disabled character being part of your group that's trying to escape the angels. But what happens to the disabled character?
Well, she gets kidnapped by an angel on like page 3 or something.
And the next time we see her, huge spoiler, she's a ravening crazy monster. Yeah. Woohoo!
She basically, the disabled sister provides sort of, well, she does. It's not sort of, she provides the impetus for Penn to do the whole thing in the book. The whole impetus for Penn is finding her sister, except it's not really her whole impetus.
No,
but that's like, supposed to be.
Yeah, and that was annoying.
Yeah.
Because she could have done something interesting with that.
Yeah.
But the next time we literally see the sister, she's been genetically modified to be a weird, I don't know what the fuck she's become. She's not a Nephilim.
No, she's got, I guess she's Nephilim 2.0.
Yeah.
I think is what's meant to have happened there.
Yeah, anyway, I dare say book 2 will deal with that.
Yeah.
For the fans. So, Kirsten, what else? Because I could keep going, but I don't want to, you know.
Oh, I just thought, I mean, so the world building was a huge problem. But I thought on the most basic level, the writing was just really.
Well, this is one of the things we want to look at.
Yeah.
Because these were self-published books.
Yes.
So I don't know who went and edited this. I mean, I think she acknowledges a whole lot of people, but the
writing is I'm really sorry all the people on Goodreads who think this is really well written, it's just not.
Yeah, but something an editor would have picked up, or is it just
Definitely.
So it's not a matter of taste thing. It's not going to be well.
No, it's not. No,
you're so
no.
pretentious, Kirsten, with your
with my liking of the words.
Yeah, liking of well edited words. Yeah.
Yeah, that's terrible, terrible liking of the well-edited words. No, it's just really overly – not. It's not even overwritten, because you can have a book that's overwritten, but it's still done skillfully. It's just this is not – yeah, there's just nothing here. It's
Do you have
really,
an example?
Well, there's several problems with the book. I mean, one is there's just so much use of very purple language, adjective for every noun, just about that sort of thing, and you know, careless repetition of language, like all this stuff that just makes you want to get your red pen out. I think one of the Well, the bit...
You've been laughing about this since I got here.
I know, because I'm just going to read out a section of this book because it's just – it's the sort of thing like, I had to read it twice to make sure I wasn't – like that it wasn't me, you know? Like, sure it's not me.
So you read it aloud to just a bunch of random strangers just to make sure.
No. I had to actually go read it to Jason and say, read this and tell me if I'm just not – if it's just me. I was assured it was not just me. So I'm going to, this is a bit where they're in this sort of survivalist quasi.
It's a resistance movie.
It's a resistance movie.
But you don't know
that in the beginning that it's a resistance movie. Yeah, you're not sure what's happening. And she basically gets into a fight with one of the rather large men at the camp.
Is this the one who says to her, "This is the new reality, sweet cheeks, except before I cram it down your throat,
something
deep and hard," and she thinks, "I can practically smell the lust and violence on you."
Oh, you've got it there, have you?
Yeah, because I highlighted that, deep and hard.
Yeah.
But I love that I can practically smell the lust and violence on him.
Yeah, so he says that to her, right? And basically she then starts the physical fight. He grabs his dick and everything and, you know, whatever. And so she starts a physical fight she slams the heel of her hand into his nose. And I don't just do it with my arm. The force comes all the way from my hips as I launch my whole body into the strike. I felt the nose smash under my onslaught. His tongue gets smashed between his teeth. His head whiplashes back. Blood sprays from his bit tongue. And basically her idea is that she'll do this then he's taller than her, he's bigger than her, he's a soldier, she's just a girl. So the other people in the camp will come and pull him off.
Yeah, and she's got in quick.
So that's kind of her calculation. And it doesn't go according to plan and they start fighting. Like he punches her in the face he punches her in the face. And it's described as he slams an SUV of a punch across my jaw. So it's a really, like, it's a massive punch. And then he's been described as, much bigger than her.
And this is a girl who hasn't been eating squid meals for some time.
Yeah. And, she lands on her back. And so the fight begins. Now, I wouldn't normally do this, but this is a really good indication, I think, of the writing in this book. And I just, as I'm reading this, Ian.
Yes.
Picture in your head.
I'm picturing right now, yes.
The words and what they're saying to you. And tell me if you picture this.
I read this bit too, so I was...
But anyway, the guy's name's Bowden, right? Bowden grabs the neck of my sweatshirt with one fist and cocks the other for another smash.
Okay, so yeah, I got that.
Okay, I just need to survive this punch, then someone is bound to reach us. I grab the pinky of the hand on my sweatshirt.
Where's she? Is she lying on the ground?
She's on her back.
Okay.
Right? And he's sitting on top of her.
So she grabs a pinky.
He's sitting on top of her. She's on her back. He's sitting on top of her. He has his fist above her.
Yeah, ready to punch.
I grab the pinky of the hand on my sweatshirt and give it the hardest twist I can, flipping it all the way over. It's a little known fact that where the pinky goes, so goes the arm.
The hand, wrist.
Hand, wrist and body. Otherwise, something breaks along the way. He jerks with it, gritting his teeth and twisting his body to follow the pinky. That's when I catch a glimpse of the people around us. Now, basically, people are just watching, right? They're not going to break in the fight, and she's a bit surprised by that. My surprise costs me. Bowden jams his elbow into my right breast. The intense pain just about kills me. I curl as best I can with 200 pounds of muscle on top of me, but that doesn't protect me from the bitch slap he whips across my face. Now he's adding insult to injury because if I had been a man, he would have hit me with a closed fist. So he slaps her. So basically, he's still on top of her now there, right, you think?
Yeah.
Despite what she did with his pinky?
Yeah, so I thought she'd flipped him over.
Yeah, but
he's gotten back on top of her.
Well, apparently he's still on top of her, yeah.
No, maybe he just got back on top of her.
Okay, maybe he just got back on top of her. Okay, so then she's looking at the people and she realises they're betting on the fight, right?
Okay.
So then while I'm taking in the scene of the people betting on the fight, I block two more hits with Bowden sitting on top of me.
She's got a... Forearms.
My forearms are taking a beating and my bruises are getting bruises. With no rescue in sight, it's time to get serious about the fight. I lift my butt and legs off the ground like a gymnast and wrap my legs around Bowden's thick neck, hooking my ankles at his throat.
How? They would have to go. Where's he sitting? Isn't he facing her?
I rock my body forward, jerking my legs down. Bowden's eyes widened as he's yanked backwards.
I'm completely confused.
Entwined, we swing like a rocking chair. He lands on his back, legs spread around my waist. I'm suddenly upright with my ankles wrapped around his throat. The instant we land, I slam my fists into his groin, and now it's his turn to curl, and that's kind of the end of the fight. She jumps up and kicks him in the face.
Did you draw drawings of this? What way? Isn't he facing her? So wouldn't her legs have to have... And how did she lift them if he's 200 pounds? Like, he's forcing... Isn't that, like, impossible in any sort of physical...
Yeah, completely and utterly impossible.
But she's obviously seen... Susan E., not Penryn, has probably seen this on some sort of... I mean, unless she's a martial art expert.
It's actually physically impossible.
You've checked this out. Did you get Jason to test it out with you?
If he's sitting on her and he is far back enough on her... to slam his elbow into her breast, which he does, then he can't be sitting on her shoulders or anything like that.
Yeah.
Right?
Unless he turns around, does it like, you know.
Well, no, he couldn't. Like, okay. He can't do that. He's got to be, right?
It's got to be a forward thrust.
So if he's sitting at least on her lower torso, if not her stomach, if not her hips.
Yeah.
There's just...
You know why that she'd be able to get the leverage up to wrap her.
There's just no
way. And how long are her legs to get
And to get... It's actually just physically impossible. Like, she couldn't... No.
Well, if anyone who does love this book knows how it's possible, feel free to send drawings in.
Oh, I put a video on YouTube.
But is that the reason you lost it for this book?
Oh, that's not the only reason. That's like an example of it just falls down. It falls down so badly. But she does.
Well, I'm going to ask you, is she a martial arts expert?
No.
Susan E.?
No.
Why? How do you know?
Well, she said on her blog that she researched the fights by looking at women's self-defense manuals and talking to a black belt martial artist.
Who probably read this and said that was fine. Come on. Well, all right, fine.
We can try if you like. Like right now, get on the floor.
Do you really want us to do it?
Like seriously, you can't do it.
Do you want me to be Penryn? This is not going to work on audio though. You're just going to hear me going, and if Jason opens the door with me straddling you, punching your breasts, I think he might do something about that.
Well, I'm going to try and get my legs up behind your back so that my ankles can go around your
throat.
You
can't do it because you're not a black belt.
Neither's Penryn. Penryn's a 17-year-old half-staff girl.
With long legs.
With a 200-pound man sitting on top of her.
And she lifted her bum somehow.
Somehow.
All right. Well, that isn't the only issue with this book, though. Because I'm certain there'll be plenty of people who will defend it.
But the writing is kind of like that all the way through. It's overly detailed where the details aren't necessary.
But it's got that sassy, irritating voice to it as well, which doesn't fit the fact that they're going through a fucking apocalypse. She basically, once she meets Raph, the angel, who loses his wings, we didn't mention that.
Yeah, they get chopped off by the other angels.
Yeah, basically she comes across, they're about to run away into the forest, her mum and her sister, and Raph and a bunch of angels come down and the other angels belt up Raph and take his wings, rip them off and throw them to the ground.
Not sure why they didn't bother killing him.
Yeah, they don't. They just seem to I missed all that. But anyway, she collects his wings. Now, remember, the angels are the evil. They're the ones who've destroyed everything. Yeah. Raph's the good angel.
He's a good angel.
We don't know that yet, but, it's 25 pages in and he doesn't break her neck and take his wings back. Yep. So we assume pretty much immediately that he's the good angel. And she sort of saves his life sort of vaguely.
Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway, so she heads off with him because she's got his wings and won't give him back until he takes her to the Aerie.
Where the birds live.
Where all the birds and angels live in San Jose or something.
San Francisco.
Whatever. It's, Silicon Valley's in San Jose. Yeah. Who cares? And that's where you get the arduous walking through the forest, getting caught by the resistance, leaving twice. The resistance, being captured by them, going back.
Caught again.
Yeah, then going off to the Aerie and then all the shit that goes on there.
Yeah.
Anywho, now that I've said all that, Raph, guess what? I don't know, it's funny because it's no great prediction, but within about five pages of him appearing, I've put in my notes in Kindle, I bet they fall in love.
Well,
but you know, no. But here's my question to you, Kirsten.
Yeah.
Possibly a sexist and gender specific question. What am I missing here? Because it shat me. The whole sexual tension thing between
it shat me too.
Angel.
I think we must both be missing it because it shat me.
Raph and Penrhyn is so fucking annoying.
Yeah.
Putting into context the fact that his species have literally wiped out most of the planet, and he might be a good angel, but he can't be fuck telling her anything.
It's really cute, though.
Oh, he's great. And she keeps going on about it and having weird wet dreams about him. And well, she does. She wakes up all, you know, and you think, oh, for fuck's sakes. Because, yes, you're working together, but it's not like he sat down with you and said, you know what, I'm actually a good angel. We're not all bad. This is all a fuck up and I'm trying to help the day. He doesn't do that. He just acts all mysterious and idiotic. And the reason he doesn't explain it, apart from the fact that it would be clunky exposition, is because Susan E. wants to drag us along and not tell us anything that would be of all interesting or important. And Penrhyn just sticks with him.
Yes. Well, I guess she
Well, her crazy
needs...
mum seems to pop in and out like the Cheshire Cat.
Maybe eating people, maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this whole subplot where we wonder whether mum, who runs off when the angels arrive early in the story, is possibly eating people, has gone to cannibalism as well. That's because she's off her meds. And I just think, fucking hell, could you think of a more stereotypical and fucked view of mental illness?
Yeah, no, it's not good.
Disabled and mental illness people do not go well in this book.
No, they don't.
So, I mean, and there was one other thing that shat me. I like gore. I like violence. But fuck, the violence against children in this, for no good reason, is fucking abysmal.
At the end.
It's not just the end. Throughout, a lot of the times that she tries to show how hard and sad and shit it is, it's through, oh, look, there's a corpse of a half-eaten child. And you think, really? Is that the only way you're going to try and get a reaction out of me about how fucked the world is?
It's a really – that's what I mean by the cannibalism stuff. Like, it's a really cheap shot.
Yeah.
You know,
and of course, it's children that we find in the end that are being fucked over by these angels, manipulated genetically, and in a really vicious, terrible, horrible way. And as I said, I don't mind violence. I love gore. I may even own some banned films in Australia. Federal police, I didn't say that. But fuck, there's a good way of using that sort of shit. And then there's just, it's cheap thrills. And fuck, no.
Yeah. Look, I just don't think.
Sorry, that's my rant.
That's your rant.
I did finish it, though.
Oh, yeah, no, well, I finished it too because I think this was the first one I started. I thought, well, I should at least finish. I ended up finishing them all. I had a really hard time not finishing books I wanted to critique, so I thought I should finish it.
Yeah, well, I say that because I did give up on two. But, look, I could have easily given up on this one. It took me forever to read, actually. Part of the reason I gave up on one book is because I've run out of time, although I would have given up on it anyway. But this actually took me 10 days to read. That shouldn't be the case. It's a 250-page book. I just didn't want to read it. Oh, and the Nephilim. She drags the Nephilim in. Don't do that.
Why?
They're overused, first off. Second off, the most obvious thing with the Nephilim is to say that they're angels based on the biblical verse. Come to the Jews, my young friend, for we have a more interesting interpretation. It's actually a lot more boring, in fact. In fact, according to Judaism, it is a sin to interpret that passage. And I'll tell you what the passage is. So okay. get your pens ready. It's from Bereshit 6:4 or Genesis 6:4, which is the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. Now, I want to say that of all the phrases or sentences in the Bible, that's one of the most awesome. As a young kid, that one set my imagination going. So I can see why a lot of writers would want to, you know, get up on that. But sons of God does not mean, okay, it does in some Christian sects, but in Judaism it does not mean angels. In fact, it's a sin to interpret it that way, to think of angels rooting around, because we have a much different view of angels than Christian mythology does. She's gone with the angel interpretation. I don't hold that against her. She just has to take the Jewish one. But it's dull. It's dull to use Nephilim as angels that have fallen and have rooted, you know, the sons of the daughters of men and have produced offspring that are vampires, basically. It's dull. It's been done before. It's not interesting. Do something interesting with the Nephilim if you're going to use them, which I say you shouldn't because it's overused. But if you are going to go that direction, it's just treat them like – Stop me. Why are you stopping me? You're just letting me talk.
No, it's interesting.
Oh, yeah. I'm so certain you're fascinated. It's the sons of God are human and they were nobles at the time, according to Judaism. Okay,
yeah, but that's just the one interpretation.
I'm not saying you have to go with that interpretation, but why angels? It's dull. It's dull, Kirsten. And then there's the last bit. Do you know how she really gets you going? Raphael is agnostic.
Well, the idea that angels haven't seen God either, so they don't know if he exists.
Did you like that idea?
No. I thought it was just a bit silly. I don't know. Again, maybe it's something that will be explored in the next.
Well, the idea is that Gabriel, I think, is the voice piece for God.
Yeah.
And no one else has seen God. So, I don't know.
It's sort of cherry picking her theology, I guess, which is what you can do in a fantasy. I mean, you can cherry pick, and as long as what you're choosing doesn't internally contradict itself in your own book.
So you think my misplaced theological issues are misplaced? That didn't make sense. My theological issues are misplaced. Is that what you're saying? You don't care enough about this book, do you?
I think that's the best way to put it. I think this is not a book you need to pick a fight with over that.
Well, look, seriously, for the people who are actually fans, unless you've got more to say, for the people who are fans of Angel Fall, good luck to them. I hope they enjoy book two. I shan't be coming back.
No, I shan't be coming back either. I don't really have much good to say about it on any level.
Why'd you finish it then?
Well, I told you it was the first one I started to read and I thought I should finish it. And there was this morbid curiosity. Really, I mean, there was sort of morbid curiosity about
Jonathan,
how it was going
to get ended.
Please
go ahead. Jonathan, your mission is to go ahead and read Angel Fall and provide a critique of your own. So that's...
You did finish it, though. So you got to the end where she's paralysed.
Yes, I did,
and she
yes.
can't move anything, not even her eyes, and yet she sees this 360-degree panorama of everything that's happening.
Yes, I noted that. Yes. Yeah.
And
they basically nearly leave her.
Yeah.
And the angel thing, and Raphael thinks she's dead and therefore flies off into the distance because he's got his wings back, except it's not his wings, they're demon wings that he's been given back with talons on them or whatever. Anyway, let's do a better book.
Okay.
So Ancient Copernicus was number two on our list, which isn't actually a book, it's a short story.
It's a novella. I think it's 20,000 words?
I think it's struggling to get to 20,000.
Okay.
But Adam Roberts, feel free to correct us if you feel that if that's how long it is. I thought it was between 10 and 15,000. On Kindle, it comes to about 40 pages. That was on the Amazon website. It said it's about 38, 40 pages. So it's interesting. Now, the rules were that we weren't to pick established authors.
Yeah.
And
You threw this in at the...
Well, no. I believe Cheryl recommended this one. Cheryl Morgan recommended this. And I said, yeah, let's do it. But it does slightly go against our rules because Adam Roberts is a very established author. But it acts as an interesting control.
Does it?
As part of our experiment.
It's an interesting control.
I would like to
that.
Tell you where it ranks on Goodreads.
we're gonna go to Goodreads for every one of
these. No, 4-6, yeah. Well,
sure.
Well, is it taking up hours of our time?
No.
I've done the research already because it took me all the 4 minutes on the tram this morning. Yes. Now, remember, Angel Fall, 8,943 ratings. As of October 18 at around about 8:10 this morning on the tram, Anti-Copernicus had 36 ratings.
As published around the same time.
Yes. With
July 2011, I have here.
Yes. With a overall rating of 3.81. So less than four.
Mm.
Now, I would argue that the people reading Anti-Copernicus...
They're probably not the same people who are reading Angel Fall.
No, probably not. And maybe a little...
Except us. We might be the crossover.
Well, we are going to be. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if Goodreads, which does those recommendations, is going to go, what the fuck? What do we do with these people? Kirsten and Ian. God, their tastes are everywhere.
Angel Fall, Anti-Copernicus. I don't know.
I think what's interesting... Now, Adam Roberts is an interesting character. I read his blog. He's, an interesting critic and... this is actually the first piece of writing of his I've read, which surprised me because I thought I'd read some stuff, but no, I haven't. And he's someone who is liked by a group of people in the UK but doesn't seem to get nominated for awards often. I mean, he in UK does get nominated for awards, but he doesn't get the wider recognition, which I think has annoyed some people. I would say based on Anti-Copernicus, I think he deserves – I mean, Ian Mond, the gatekeeper Ian Mond, thinks he deserves much wider recognition because I thought it was great. But but it's interesting that, you know, and a so-called established author, probably more middle-list than best-selling, mm-hmm. 36 ratings on Goodreads. Again, I know it's not – I mean, you know, maybe people who read Adam Roberts don't sign up to Goodreads. But, you know, and that's very possible. But still, you know, it's a bit of a poor – a poor situation. What does that say about our reading culture, Kirsten? There's an under the bus sort of question. Anyway, it's not. That's not. No, no.
Let me pick myself up off the floor.
I'll leave that one as a rhetorical one. So, what notes do you have there?
Not much actually. Although I am going to point out a series of blog posts written by Rich Pulchowski. He may have got a higher word count than the actual novella in his series of reviews. But it's a really interesting series in five parts, which looks at Anti-Copernicus and the science that's in the story.
Yeah,
and
I knew
the themes
written,
of the story.
I knew Rich had written that, but I hadn't read them. They're good.
Yeah, they're very good. So we'll put links to them in the show notes. And he even talks about the nature of an ebook. So I'd definitely recommend reading them.
It's look, the package of, and we didn't really talk about the package of Angel Fall, apart from the fact that we didn't like the writing or the story or anything of it. I actually think Angel Fall's got a really good cover.
It has a great cover.
It's a beautiful cover.
It's a fantastic
I really enjoyed
cover.
The cover. It looks really nice on your Kindle or iBook or whatever device. Anti-Copernicus, I also think, has a pretty striking cover.
Yeah.
It's more simplistic.
Yep.
I just like the way, I just like the star field behind it. It looks nice.
It's very nice and elegant.
Yeah, it's elegant. You're good with words. You should write. So, by the way, Angel Fall, great cover.
Yes.
Well done there.
We can. That's a good thing we can say about it.
But I would say that in 40 pages, Anti-Copernicus mm-hmm. has more ideas and more stuff going on it than all the books we read. Possibly aside from one, which I won't say.
Well.
Okay, I will. Paintwork. But it definitely has more ideas in it per page than Angel Fall does per 250.
Oh,
I don't want to keep shitting
on
Angel Fall, but really this, what I loved about this was that.
Well, it is a completely different book though. Angel Fall is essentially it's a dystopian young adult romance. That's what it is.
But you talked about world building.
Yes.
And that's where all the smarts are in these sorts of books. Okay, you're sitting in Silicon Valley or the real world, but you've just gone and done an apocalypse. Now here's your chance to do something different with that.
Yep.
Subvert it, whatever. Or even don't have to subvert it, just do something good with it. And world build. And she does all the obvious stuff.
Yeah, and the world building falls down and all of that. But, I mean, that's not what Anti-Copernicus is doing.
Well, Anti-Copernicus is also taking...
So it's a little apple and oranges.
No, it's not, because Anti-Copernicus is taking also a well-oiled idea, First Contact, mm-hmm. and doing something incredibly smart with it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, from that point of view.
One's 210 pages shorter than the other, but this one's got more depth to it, far more depth. And probably a more interesting character, even though she's a bit of an odd one. But
I think she's a really interesting character. I really liked Ange because she wasn't she didn't really conform to a lot of the expectations of a female protagonist in a science fiction novel, really, to put it bluntly.
Okay, yeah. Unpack this. I'm interested.
And I guess honestly, a lot of female characters. I think she's really complex. She's not easily likable, but you do like her. She thinks a lot. She's very introspective, but she's not obsessed with herself and what she's feeling and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Which is really good because often when you get introspective characters, it's kind of all about them.
She's not overly neurotic. She obviously has just a couple of neuroses.
Yeah, but everyone does.
She's a bit of a weird misanthrope, sort of a compassionate misanthrope is how I'd put it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
That's how I write in my notes.
So I think she's a really complex character, and I think what Adam Roberts manages to do in quite a short space of words is to create this very believable character without using not resorting, that's not the right word either, without going into that really intensive he doesn't use first person, but it's not even an intensive third person. It's a very told story.
Yes.
And yet
this is the tale of Anne.
Yes.
Yeah.
For me, when, you know, there's a lot of talk about strong female characters, and I think there's a lot of mislabeling and misinterpretation of that phrase. For me, a character like Ange is a tremendously strong female character.
She's competent.
It's not even well, for me, when you talk about strong female characters, it's strong like coffee, strong like yeah. There has to be complexity there. It's not strong as in I've got muscles and I'll beat you up. It's not even strong as in
I'm good at what I do.
You know, I'm great at what I do, yeah. And I win stuff and I'm the best and you know, I overcome odds. It's about complexity, it's about depth, it's about creating a fully realized three-dimensional, four-dimensional human being that you believe in, yep. Whether that person is, you know, physically strong or smart or even competent. I mean, you know, I would have no problem with a character who wasn't any of those things but was still, you know, real and complex and not a stereotype and not something that's just put in the story to drive the plot or what have you. And I think the character of Ange is really good for that. I think she's quite a remarkable character.
I agree. I think as you said, it's a credit to Roberts that he can do it in such a short space. Yes, it's all through her perspective.
Yeah.
But coupled with all the ideas that are in the story, and we should say what it's about because I haven't done that, and I'm not going to spoil this one much because I actually want people to go because well, people haven't read
it. We won't spoil the ending, but I think we can talk about the premise.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's First Contact.
Yeah.
So humanity have noted a...
They've been contacted by...
Been contacted by radio...
What seems like an alien intelligence.
Yeah, and a ship out in the Oort cloud. And a group are going on a ship, I think the Leibniz, which is a philosopher, Leibniz, who I studied in uni.
They're going to meet the aliens.
They're going to go and meet the
aliens.
And
in the beginning, Ange was selected to go as part of the crew, and then she isn't, and...
which I thought was a bit of play. You know, this is
so which you know at that point that she is actually going to be the person who has first contact.
I actually didn't think that.
I actually did think
he was going to be really, really smart and have this be nothing, have all the first contact stuff actually happen off stage.
I was hoping for that.
Reason why I haven't given this 5 out of 5
yeah.
Because even though I did like the last 10 pages and how it all comes together, there was a part of me that thought, you know, it would have been awesome if she'd not had the first contact, if actually just been about this story about
this
woman.
But that's a different story.
It probably is.
That's not this story.
No, it's not. Yeah. And you're right. It's expectation for what doesn't exist. You're right. Still, it's a small quibble. so she goes on and her job is to ferry containers, whatever, from Mars to Earth, backwards and forwards.
Yep.
And that's what she's doing with a crew of three, and things occur on the ship, and we've already spoiled the fact that she does end up meeting the aliens. But what that actually means and
we
how
won't
it
spoil
works
that.
We won't spoil because that is the beauty of the story.
Yeah.
But what Roberts has done is a really smart inverse is not the right word, but whatever. I hate using all those technical academic critique words. He's taken the first contact story and does something really clever with it.
He does.
Extremely clever. At the same time, he also is able to bring in that idea of the sense of wonder without belaboring it. Because you do feel the feel of space and discovery and out there, but without making it all about that. And you know what also is great? It's funny.
It is. There's some.
It's the only funny thing we read, except for bits of paintwork.
There is funny bits in there.
Why are all these people po-faced? Angel 4, I know it's the end of the world.
There's meant to be a lot of funny stuff in it. I think some of that.
Do you think Angel 4's meant to be funny?
I think some of that, the dialogue is meant to be funny. And, yeah, I didn't find it funny. I found it forced and yeah. No, there's genuine humour in it, Copernicus.
Because the aliens, when they communicate, just say, you know, come to us and we'll be waiting. We've seen all your television, your cloud images and the data that rushes and rushes and rushes. So be assured, we will not hurt you. Us? Hurt you? Pull the other one. There's something very Kurt Vonnegut about it.
That's also, like, in retrospect, though, once you know the ending, it's also really sad.
Yes, it is.
Because once you know what's actually happening, yeah.
It also has one of my favourite lines that I read in all these books, which is, you know, there's it's a talk about why can't they just communicate? Why can't they just, what is it? There's also the feeling that the Cygnus, they're from Cygnus, so Cygnix,
yep,
were averse to being too proximate to the sun. Maybe our solaration is toxic to them. Maybe they are deep space species, only truly at home in the dark between the stars. Why can't we just ask them? We can, but they are not very forthcoming, or they answer with chatter and chaff, or they hum and hoom like ants. Yeah. Oh, that was cute. Yes, it's a bit of Tolkien, but it was cute. So, but I like the fact that it was a bit funny.
Yeah.
And it's good humour.
It is. Why do you sound apologetic?
Because it was one of the last things I read.
Yeah.
Because I thought it might be good and I knew I would need a bit of a
palate. Saved it to the end.
And it's a lovely palate cleanser as well. And I don't know why I use that description, but I've been watching a lot of Great British Menu recently. It's interesting because he is the established author of the six that we're reading, and I think it shows very clearly in this work.
I think it does. I
don't know who edited this and if anyone did, but
I think on a level of technique and prose skill and expertise. I mean, this is not a story you would be surprised to find as is in an anthology
Yeah.
It's really clean prose. It has a really nice voice. It's a little out of the purview of the spirit of the podcast, but but as you say, it's
a good control.
It's a good control.
Yeah, and I think more than 36 people should be ranking this on Goodreads.
Yeah, but as you say, there might not be the crossover of readership with Goodreads.
Well, Adam Roberts has recently talked about on his blog, and it's not his adamroberts.com blog, it's his Euro Prog Contestivision Cross, that title does me in, blog. He's recently posted on 13th of October, The Bioshock Paradigm is the title of the post, where he quotes at length an essay published by John Lanchester from the London Review of Books about video games. And what the point of the post, and quoting it, is that the essay talks about how gamers are always looking for difficulty in video games. In mm-hmm. fact, that's what they're always striving for.
Yeah.
The more difficult the game, the better. Whereas in mainstream, but also I suppose in genre fiction, we push away from the idea of the difficult. We just want the easy read. We want the very simplistic. Very simplistic is not the right word, but mm-hmm.
No, I know what he's saying, yeah.
He says, and I'll quote him after he's done a long quote of this essay, he says, "In the spirit of that sentiment, I say, often science fiction and fantasy is too easy. As to why this should be, why that is, the same fans who actively prize difficulty in their video games spurn it as they might spurn a rabid dog when it crops up in their novels and short stories. Well, that's a profound and unsettling question. From time to time, I had to go at addressing it when I reviewed, and occasionally on this blog too. At the very least, one of the aesthetic crotchets that informed my own reviewing was a preference for the difficult over the easy. An active valorisation of the friction of the best art, not despite the fact that I was reviewing SFF, but precisely because of it. The problem with realism, it seems to me, is that it's almost inevitably superficial. But the problem with the metaphorical modes of fiction, science fiction, fantasy, magic, realism and the like, is that almost they are too deep." And I thought that was quite a profound comment, considering the books we've just read and how they all seem to, except for this Adam Robbins one, and I'll say Paintwork again to a degree, do art a bit more difficult. Not that they're hard to read, not that they put, try to do a James Joyce, not because they quote from Finnegan's Wake, that's also James Joyce, literary, but because they pound you with ideas and because they're about something. Mm. And I possibly, for the next book we're about to talk about, I'd be hard-pressed to point out what at least three of the books we read for this podcast are actually about.
Yeah,
What are they trying to tell me other than being, it's a sexual tension thing between an angel and a woman, or it's,
I agree to a certain extent with what Roberts is saying there. But I guess what it comes down to is the reasons for reading, and I think also the reasons for playing games. I mean, that's...
They're the same reason, though.
Well,
it's usually escapist.
Oh, well,
isn't it? That's what we often say. I read SF and F because I want to escape from I don't know what, but
It's a, do we say that?
People, well, that's I have said it in the past.
Yeah.
Younger, Ian, but I've never actually thought about it carefully.
Yeah. I think, I mean, escapist is, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, if that's, you know, in terms of, if it's escapist in terms of a permanent escape and permanently wanting to close your eyes to what's happening in the world and what other people are like and engagement and all of that stuff, then yes, there's something wrong with that.
Yeah.
But in terms of, I just want to read a fun book for 2 hours and forget about the shit that's in my life. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
But I still think that goes back to the point of that essay, which you haven't read, so slightly unfair on you, that people who play games at the highest difficulty level, the challenge of the game is the fun element.
Yeah, yeah.
They're getting an adrenaline rush, the joy. So,
I'm pretty sure
the argument here is, well, even reading a difficult novel, whether it's written narratively difficulty or the concepts and themes are difficult, there's that challenge, and that's a lot of fun too.
Sure, but there are different modes of engaging with entertainment, if you want to phrase it like that, and playing games does engage you on a very physical level. But
why is the default for fiction?
Well, I mean, reading is
fun and fluffy. That seems to be. Is that the default?
I don't know. Well, I don't know, and I mean, I don't. I mean, it's an interesting supposition that Adam Roberts has, in that he's saying, not having read the essay, but just from what you read.
Well, the essay was John Lanchester, I should say. I read the bit that Adam Roberts wrote following. He quotes about this BioShock paradigm.
And then he wrote.
Then he comments on it.
Well.
To tie it back to SF&F.
Okay, so if what Adam Roberts is comment then on the essay, if I'm following it correctly, he's saying that the same group of people who value difficulty in video games value non-difficulty in fiction.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know if that's true. I'd have to see.
Well, to be fair to you and to be fair to Adam Roberts, let me just quote a little bit as well from – we've gone completely off the topic here, but this is really interesting. No, fuck it. That's what we're here for. From John Lanchester, which he puts in. It's quite a lengthy quote, but I'm not going to do it all. So he says, if I had to name one high cultural notion that had died in my adult life, it would be the idea that difficulty is artistically desirable. It's a bit of an irony that difficulty thrives in the newest medium of all, that's video games, and it's not by accident either. One of the most common complaints regular gamers make in reviewing new offerings is that they are too easy. It would be nice if a little bit of that leaked over into the book world. So, yeah, so again, and Roberts just echoes that thought. So it's really the John Lanchester essay that makes the claim, and Roberts then ties it into a more SF&F specifically idea that I review books as Adam Roberts because I'm looking for that bit of friction, that bit of difficulty, and I get disappointed a lot when SF&F lets me down because it takes the easy road. I might be putting a lot of words into Mr. Roberts' mouth. Feel free to contradict me. But I come back to what we've read as self-published works, and I feel that the works we've read, apart from a couple, do seem to take the safe road.
Well, I think
to get the Goodreads votes.
Sure, but
controversial.
A little bit controversial. But look, to be fair, if that's the level of critique, I think a hell of a lot, if not the majority of mainstream published books are exactly the same.
Yeah, I don't think you disagree.
The amount of books that I've read that I just think this is just, it's not bad. It's just there's nothing there. Like, why did I waste, not waste even, but why, I mean, what have I gotten out of these hours I spent with this book? It hasn't really engaged me reading it. It's left no gaps for me to think about things while I'm reading it. And I'm not even really thinking about any book in particular at this point. There's a lot of them. You just read them and the author is telling you everything. The author is leaving you no space to even contemplate the book itself while you're reading it. You're just told everything. You're sort of handheld through the book. And that's in terms of, I guess, any philosophical underpinnings or thematic concerns, but it's also just in terms of the story and the characters and you know, there seems to be there is obviously a very welcoming audience for that type of a book, that sort of hand-holding book, where you're told everything. You're told what the characters are thinking and why they're thinking it and why they thought that and, you know, what they're feeling and what happens now and why that happened and what the explanation for that is. And it leaves you as a reader, it leaves you no space. It leaves you no space to sit within that book.
The problem is, though, Kirsten,
about the story for yourself.
Any critique of that stuff gets you labelled as an elitist. So our criticism of Angelfall from the 9,000 people who said it was great on Goodreads, we'll get them saying, well, they're just elitist. They just don't get it. They just want everything difficult and hard, and that obviously it's not for them.
It's not difficult. There's a difference between a book or a short story, as with Adam Roberts, being conceptually difficult, having content or subject matter that relies on specialist knowledge or a history of a field,
like anything written by Greg Egan,
right? And I'm not saying that that's necessarily elitist, but I'm saying there's a difference between that, or a book which uses really technical language or really dense language, okay. Right?
Yeah.
There's a difference between that and a book which just allows the reader space in the book.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Right. It doesn't necessarily mean the book is full of, you know, like ideas you need a PhD to get through or prose that you need a dictionary to look up every fourth
word. And you're not necessarily talking about ambiguity. You're just saying space for the reader to put his or her own input into the narrative.
And I guess,
whether it's interpretation or
I guess also a trust that from the part of the author or the editor or the publisher or whoever's behind it, a trust that the reader is willing to do that and can do that. You know, you don't have to explain everything to the reader. You don't have to handhold the – or maybe you do. I don't know anymore. I mean, this is the thing. Because,
well, you're right.
Because these handheld books, handholding books are really, really, really popular. Like really popular. And a lot of it is because you can read them and you don't have to think. You don't even have to think on the level of, oh, why did that character say that? What could be going through their head? Because you're told what's going through their head in the next sentence after their dialogue. I mean, it's that level. It's not the level of – you know, needing all this specialist knowledge to understand a book. It's on the level of inviting the reader into the story, inviting the reader to bring their mind with them and think about it while they're reading the book. Because reading's not passive. Reading isn't like watching a film. You know, you literally can sit there in front of a television and not think and watch a film.
Yeah.
You can't do that with a book. If you just sit there and look at a page... nothing happens. You know, reading is active.
Yes.
Right. So the reader's already there. They're already engaging their mind. And so let them in. Let them have space. Let them think about stuff. Let two readers sit down afterward and saying, is that how you read that? Wow, you thought that character was being really nasty. I actually thought what they were doing was this. Let that happen. Don't say everything. And unfortunately, there's so many books, like self-published but also professionally published, which they tell you everything. And for me, that is such a boring book.
I just wanted self-published to be better. maybe that was completely naive of me because people will often say, I'll explain. Because people would say, well, self-published because they couldn't get an editor because, you know, they're obviously crap. But no, I wanted to go in thinking, no, the reason they haven't been published – isn't because they're crap, but because they're saying something that mainstream publishers aren't ready for. They're not there yet, and therefore, this is the only avenue or medium that's going to work.
And I think that's
what I was hoping for. But we got basically.
And I think that those books might be out there, and I think possibly we got one, which we'll talk about. I think that's a lovely romantic myth.
Yeah, well.
I don't think that's the bulk of self-published books. It's because, you know, it's not that they were.
Well, I know it's not. I really know it's not because my Twitter account, I followed a whole lot of people I shouldn't have followed unfollow them who spent all their day just telling you about the 5-star ratings on their latest self-published magnum opus.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know. But anyway.
Yeah, I think Yeah, I mean,
no, that's what you've said is fair. That I like that idea of giving you a room to breathe, room to move within the text.
I think you have, and look, as a reader, that's what I want. But as I said, I mean, these types of books, these heavy expositional books, which is really what they are. Yeah. Are really, really, and they're incredibly easy to read. They're so easy to read. You don't have to think. You really can skim them almost. I mean, they're so easy to read. And I guess in this, I'm on the side of Roberts and
John Lanchester.
Lanchester, in that as a reader, they're not the types of books I want.
Yeah.
I don't want that. I'm happier to have that in movies, although that's getting less and less these days too. And I think maybe that's because watching film can be quite passive.
Yeah.
Although, as I said, that's getting less and less. I'm getting very fussy about film and television as well. But with books, I don't like easy books in that sense. I like a book that I feel like I'm – as a reader, I feel that I am as much a part of bringing this – book into existence as a story.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
As the writer is.
Yes. Yeah, no. That's. Yeah.
I'm happy with. I'm more than happy with. I love the idea that I can read this book and 100 other people can read this book and we can all get something slightly different out of it. Whereas, yeah, with a book that is so expositional, everyone reads the same book.
And here you were in the last podcast getting all cynical about the act of reading, and now look at you. You're being all. You're inspiring
me. I'm not saying I'm finding a lot of those books.
Just to, you know, bring it back to the actual topic.
Yeah.
Anti-Copernicus, I think, does that because I think it's quite.
I think it definitely does that. It necessitates you to bridge gaps.
And obviously Richard Pulaski thinks that because he's written a bazillion words on it.
A very nice little series.
And as you said, all justified. It's not like he's just writing for the sake of writing.
No, it's a very nice little series of interrogations, really.
So I think a book that gets close but probably doesn't get the cigar for me is The Dark Wife.
Oh, we're moving on.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think
interesting segue.
Yeah, well.
Okay.
Because I think it's a book that could have given more room to breathe, like a good wine. That's what we're talking about, Eve. Good wines? Did you say room to breathe?
I said, well, room for the reader to breathe.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Well, I think, The Dark Wife. So it's written by Kirsten.
Sarah Deemer.
Yes.
And this was obliquely recommended by Stephanie Gunn. She didn't actually.
What do you mean obliquely?
Well, she didn't actually email us for the podcast and say you should read this book, but she recommended it.
Just to you.
On
a sunny Sunday.
No, on her blog.
Oh,
as a really good self-published ebook that was really good and should be read. And when we did – this was one of the things that actually inspired me to think of this idea for the podcast.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, it's Sarah Deemer's
fault. So I wanted to include it.
Just to start the cover. What do you think of the cover?
Oh, the cover's nice. It's okay.
I think it's just the way it's set out on my Kindle. It just doesn't
– Oh, really?
Have a look at that.
Oh, it just sits there in the middle of all the
white.
Yeah,
it's like this little picture sitting in the middle of all this white.
Well, that's not really the cover's fault.
Yeah, it's probably just my technologist's fault. But no, but to be fair, you've got to – when you're doing this stuff, you've got to build it for anyone's device.
See, I just read the PDF of that, so
– Did you?
Yeah, because I quite like reading the PDF on my tablet.
Okay, all right. Well, yeah, so that's the cover. So it was a recommendation by Steph.
Yep.
So what's it about?
Well, it's a retelling of the myth of Persephone, who was the goddess who was taken down to the underworld and kept by Hades until her mother Demeter, in the myth, not in The Dark Wife, basically said, that's it, end of the world, unless my daughter comes back, winter forever, because Demeter's the goddess of fertility and spring and rebirth and all of that sort of stuff. And so when her daughter was taken by Hades down into the underworld, she said, that's it, winter forever unless my daughter comes back. And so Persephone, who's been depressed the whole time she's been down in the underworld, as you would be, and refusing to eat or drink or anything because she just wants to go home, she's so happy when Hades comes and relents and says, fine, you can go home, that she is tricked into eating three seeds of a persimmon. No,
it's a pomegranate.
Sorry, a pomegranate. And those three seeds end up being the 3 months that she then has to come back every year and spend in Hades.
Once again.
She has to come back down to the underworld and spend those 3 months every year.
My Jewish school education, where we were taught Bible stories, meant that I had no idea about this myth.
Yep.
The Persephone story.
It's a really...
Well, it's well known, isn't it?
Really well-referenced myth.
Yeah, so you were spoiled for this before you even started it.
No, it's not spoiled.
Well, it is, because the whole pomegranate thing that's in here and
but
Hades.
But
Zeus, it's, you know?
it's not spoiled, though, because, in fact, what it is, in fact, not to be too elitist about it, Mr. Mond, I would say my reading experience was enhanced being familiar with the original myth, because then I could see what Sarah Deemer was doing with the myth and how she was deconstructing it and pulling it apart and putting it together. And, I mean, it's a good book to read. But I think having a familiarity with the Greek myths that it touches upon, you do get that extra
enhancement. You like this one more than me.
I think I did like it more than you.
Because I think it's a good novella. I think it's a good book. I think it's too long. Well, it's too
long. Oh, I see what you're about to say. It's not a novella, but no, I see what you mean. You think it should be a novella.
Yeah, it's 255 pages. Yep. I think it could have easily had a good 20,000 cut off. And I think a lot of
when she's down in the underworld.
Yes, I think a lot of the stuff in the underworld, now, don't get me wrong, some of the best ideas are in that section, because that's, to be frank, the meat and potatoes of the book. But I think a lot of that, she does, Persephone does very little, just seems to, mope around's not the right word. She goes and talks to the horses or feeds the horses and does a few things like that, but it doesn't do very much. And the other thing that shat me, and we should say this is both Angelfall and this are young adult books. At least they've been marketed, sold, considered as young adult. One thing that shat me was just the constant sexual tension again between Persephone and Hades. Now, Hades in this retelling is not a man, it's a woman. So, and I don't mind the fact that it's a lesbian thing. I've got no problems with that. It's just that I just wanted them to get their thing on earlier. That crackling tension.
Yeah, but the unresolved sexual tension is a staple of narrative. Always has been.
I'm not saying it shouldn't be there, but it's quite clear halfway through the novel that both of them want to get it on big time with each other. They want to shag, but they just don't want to seem to admit it to themselves.
Well, no, I think there's actually a line in there which I don't know if I highlighted or not, and I quite appreciated it because it was, I think Persephone was saying something like she recognized that, like, they have both, Hades and Persephone have both acknowledged that they have this growing attraction. But Hades doesn't want to rush in. It's as simple as that. It's not that they're both denying it.
I miss that.
See, it's not your standard unresolved sexual tension where the characters pretend then they don't like each other and it's all, you know, they either hate each other or they just don't like it. You know, it's not that. It's this growing together of, I think, the two women who are acknowledging this attraction but not wanting to rush into something and maybe jump the gun or spoil it by rushing in too early. And I quite liked that.
Yeah, all right. That's a fair reading. I don't agree with you.
Okay,
but just for me, it meant that we got really overwrought writing, as such as
the writing,
my heart tumbled over with gratitude. I was safe, alive, and I determined never to take a second of my immortal life for granted again. Which actually isn't so bad. But
I know what you mean.
Sorry, that actually wasn't such a bad line. It was another one. Which is, yes, I sat up and looked upon her face, her plain, dear, beautiful face with a long, straight nose and a solemn eyes. I found perfection in every feature, though it was her heart I loved best. And that's not once. That's a lot.
I
wanted to do myself in after
I will
all.
Agree with you there. I did find several times, so with, you know, regularity, that the prose did dip just a little too much into the Baroque and the overwrought. And sometimes you could – sometimes it I think it built the character of Persephone because especially at the beginning when she was a lot younger emotionally.
Yeah.
But I think by the end when the writing was sort of still like – I think I would have liked to have seen a maturity in the prose to match Persephone's maturity.
From innocence to
yeah, and the prose, yeah. Even at the end, I found the prose still a little overwrought at times. And again, this is one that I think, you know, it would benefit from having a clearer eye on the prose, perhaps. It's really hard for writers to come at their own work sometimes with that sort of perspective.
I dare say she talks about beta readers.
Of course, yes. But the I have.
What are you suggesting? Because who does she give this to? I mean, she obviously will probably think that this is the right length. The writing's not overwrought. Her friends and others who have read it have probably said, yep, this is ready to go, publish. But I'm an independent person. I don't know Sarah. To me, it was a bit too full on. It could be a taste thing. But no, I think it's more than that because it does get into that purple prose side too often for me.
Yeah, and I don't think it bolstered the characterization of the story, especially in the latter half. Which is a shame, but again, this is it. Again, I've read really bad books that have been published by really huge publishers. It's not like there's an either or situation here. I guess you tend to be a bit more critical of a self-published book.
I actually wanted to go into this. Yep. I told you, I wanted to go into this open-minded and I wasn't going to, self-published, therefore it's dirty. But when I see, you know, I was suddenly shy, the light from the sun illuminating every flaw I saw in myself, every weakness. I looked upon Hades, saw the strength and the beauty and unblemished character of her, the woman I'd fallen in love with so deeply, and I wondered silently if I was enough for her. That's just another example. I mean, look, some people love that sort of stuff. I got tired of it.
Yeah, and I think that's – you read any one of these – out and they
that's 90% of the way through the story.
Yeah, I mean, for that, you know, that's a really nice portrait of how a young girl in love.
But it's 90% of the way through the
story.
And
this is the problem. This repetition of that type of thing, I think, is a problem, and I think it does hamper the characterization. And then the characterization of the relationship between Persephone and Hades.
Yeah.
But
let's not belabor the point because it's probably the only issue I've got.
Yeah, because I think there's a lot to really like about this book.
The is it Elysian or Elysian?
Elysian Fields.
Elysian Fields. I loved what she does with that.
I love the whole construction of the underworld. The ferryman.
He's a genuinely chilling, frightening sort of character. It's very, very clever. Very, really good. In fact, I've noted there's one real scary bit where. Genuinely scary, where she falls under the water.
Yeah, and she can't get to the shore. The construction of the underworld and sort of the dismantling of the traditional Greek myths around Hades and Zeus and the Pantheon, I think were really, really good.
Talk more about the Elysian Fields because I thought that was remarkable. It's the best thing. It's one of the best ideas about all the books we've read, including Anti-Copernicus, this idea that it is exactly what we've been told, the Elysian Fields. They are beautiful, rolling, wheat.
Blue sky, wheat, lovely weather.
But, of course, it's for the fallen soldiers who go there.
The heroes
of wars well fought, except, of course, every hero has blood on their hands.
Yep, and they get to sit there under the sun.
And think about,
what they've done.
And think about all the children they've killed, all the women they've raped, all the people they've harmed, and that's all they do. They sit there in misery.
Yeah.
And juxtapose that, you've got the other dead who are looking to mutiny against Hades because they want access to the fields because they're saying that all the warriors get that and we get shit. We literally have to stand around the dark, dank caves of the underworld. And they're constantly being told, no, you don't want to go there. Seriously, you do not want to go to the Elysian Fields. It's fucked.
But they think they've just been propaganda. Told that because they're not allowed to go there.
Yeah, that's propaganda. It is great. Yeah. And that as a narrative a device as well that pushes the plot is wonderful. Love that.
It is. And the way that is resolved is quite beautiful.
Yes. And again, and she does it smartly because it gives Persephone a moment to shine. Yep. It's probably the only time I really felt something for Persephone as a character.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I really like Persephone. But again, I'm bringing so much. Part of the what I loved about this novel, and I really did. I mean, I have reservations about it, but I really overall really did love the book. And I'm going to get more of Sarah's work. She's written some. She's written with her partner, or her wife actually. They're legally married. Her wife and Sarah, whose name is Jen. They've co-written some fairy tales.
Are either of them traditionally published?
No, they're completely self-published. And as of April this year, I think Sarah said she was supporting herself from her royalties and book sales.
Really?
Yes.
Because she's got a lot of books out there. This is not the first.
This was the first.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Wait a moment. It was published in 2011.
Last year. Yep. Yeah, no, so yeah, so her wife, Jennifer, so they've co-written Sappho's Fables,
okay,
which is a lesbian fairy tale series,
yep.
Which is one I really want to get and read. She also writes adult fiction under the pen name Alora Bishop.
Okay. So I'm just having a count here. There's a lot of Sugar Moon, Far, The Witch Sea, Seek, Our Lady of Wolves, We Grow Accustomed to the Dark, The Forever Star, Hallows Eve, Upon Hallows Eve, The Solstice Night. She writes adult lesbian fiction under the pen name Alora Bishop as well.
Yep.
The Cage of Darlings. There's a lot here. Yep. Sappho's Fables, as you said.
Well, The Dark Wife 12, 11, was her 13. Debut novel.
Wow.
But, this is how you make a living when you self-publish, is you have to publish and publish and publish and publish.
Yeah, but what about quality? Because
you're selling your books so cheaply that...
How do you maintain quality? You just don't? Because, I haven't read...
This is a question.
Look, yeah. I'm interested to see what you think of her other work and if you
yeah,
think...
Yeah, no, the same. No, I...
On
there's
The
someone
Dark
definitely
Wife
having...
alone, I probably wouldn't
okay.
pick up another book. I would probably pick up... I'm interested in the short story collection because I'm interested to see how she does shorter work. But a longer piece, maybe not, unless you recommend it. I don't know.
Fairy tales and mythology and all of that sort of stuff is something I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be a lot more open, a lot more forgiving of flaws in work if I'm interested in the work itself.
Yeah, but
if that makes
Angel
sense.
Angel Falls mythology? Yes, I'm sorry. No, it's Christian Judo-Christian mythology. Yes, it is.
It didn't do anything with the mythology.
Well, duh.
That's what I mean. It didn't do anything with the mythology.
All right.
So it was boring. Whereas what Sarah Deem is doing with The Dark Wife, and as I said, I haven't read anything else of hers, but what she's doing with this novel is she is tackling that mythology head on and she's pulling it to pieces and she's asking, well, what if the stories we're told aren't the stories that happened? And what if you look at it from this angle? And what if you substitute this character? And what if you mess about with gender? And what if you look at the Elysian Fields in a different way? And what if you do this? I mean, that's the type of books I really like.
No.
So I'm willing to sort of forgive a little purple prose and a little, you know, things here and there, because I think what she's, as an overall project, what she's doing is fascinating and really, really engaging.
Is it reasonably new to make Zeus out to be a raping asshole who basically has incestuous rooting with his children?
That's what he did. You know the leader in the swan tale, right?
No.
Oh. I'll tell you that later.
Can you tell me now?
Well, Zeus turned into a swan. And swans, by the way, are one of the very few birds who actually have a penis and not just a cloaca.
I've learned something.
There you go.
Yes.
He turned into a swan, raped a woman called Leda, although for a long time it was just seduced, but no, not really. And that's how he had one of his children. I can't remember which one.
But does the Greek mythology make Zeus to be a complete ass?
Zeus is – no. Well – It depends. No, I mean the gods. All of the gods, they're gods. They're not humans. They don't do things.
And
that
one of the things she's got a cosmology here where she talks about the three. Hades is the underworld. Zeus is the sky, and the thingamajig is the water.
Poseidon. Yep.
So that's consistent with Greek mythology,
yes.
And that there's a mother
Gaia. Yep.
Gaia.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
I'm sorry. Yep. I'm so naive on this. I was the same with Seahart and Margot Langer. I really am sorry.
No, but if that's not something that you've – I don't remember being taught this in school. I think maybe we may have done a little bit of Greek in high school or something. I can't remember. But I used to read this stuff when I was younger as a kid.
The Greeks persecuted the Jews for a good few hundred years. Back to Sarah and her work.
No, but what I was saying, so because the subject matter she's dealing with and the way she's dealing with it, that drags me through the book beyond the prose, which can be a little bit, as we've spoken about. And, you know, I had some other little quibbles with it. Well, I'm still kind of on the fence actually about what happens to her first girlfriend, the nymph, who's by Zeus.
She's raped by Zeus and turns into a shrub.
Yes, she is.
Well, that's what do you mean?
Yeah, but that is sort of the motivating. It's
not just the motivating. I think her mum sort of hints to her, "You better run away. You're about to be rooted by your dad."
I know, but she, I think. Well, it's kind of fridging, if you know what I mean.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see.
You know?
It motivates her hatred for Zeus, but it doesn't motivate necessarily her running away to Hades.
Well, I think – no, it doesn't. But as I said, I was like back and forth on this and it's like, oh, I am really – like even in a book with so many female characters and, you know, a lesbian reworking of Greek myth and all of this stuff and lots of discussion about gender and love and – politics,
The discussion about love, I don't have a discussion about gender specifically.
Well, the whole Hades thing.
Yeah, she's a woman, I know that, but it's not. There is a bit of a discussion of, aren't you meant to be a bloke, sort of.
Yeah, because that's what Zeus is telling everyone.
Yeah, that never made much sense to me, because, I mean, Hades comes to court or whatever. People would see that it's not a man.
Well, so. Hades very rarely comes to Olympus.
Okay. All right, anyway, yes. Okay, I didn't. What I'm trying to say is that yes,
and it's
love,
the story among the people that's being spread.
Yes, love, agreed. But yes. The gender, I wasn't as convinced. Other than the fact that it's a piece of lesbian fiction or gay fiction, I didn't see gender as being core to it.
Or the whole swapping out of Hades as a man for a woman, and why that's done.
Okay, so okay,
I think the gender's a pretty big card in the book. But okay. What was I saying? I was saying
about the nymph.
Oh yeah. So and yet, is it another story where the rape and murder of someone's female lover becomes, you know, an impetus, a motivating factor, a push to? And
but it doesn't motivate her to do anything specific. She doesn't go and try and kill Zeus.
No, and that's I think that's why she's
just really shitty with the bloke.
Well, doesn't even have. Well, yeah, but it's one of these things, right? Oh, it's so tragic for Persephone because her lover was raped and killed. But her lover was like, that's the bigger tragedy. Like, actually, really, when you look at things, like the fact that, I forget Persephone.
Yeah.
You know, like, because it's usually a man, right? Whose wife or girlfriend is raped and or killed.
And the focus is
right?
always on the
And it's always on the tragedy survivor, of him, yeah. right? Forget about the tragedy for the woman who's raped and or murdered.
Yeah.
That's not to say you can't use that. It's just, again, pointing out that this is a trope that is used a lot and has worn very thin. So I think when you do use it, you need to be careful. And I think what I liked about how the dark wife used that was that for so long it was really poor Persephone. Poor Persephone. You know, oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. And it was just beginning to get a little wearing when Persephone herself kind of flips around and there's this scene where she actually starts thinking about how it is, you know, how it is for her lover,
yep.
to have this fate.
Yeah,
and she stops thinking about how bad it is for herself that this happened to her, and her lover was raped in front of her and turned into a shrub, and she lost the love of her. You know,
yeah.
She stops thinking about how that is for her, and begins to think about how it actually was for the nymph that happened to, and what it must be like
for
her
that
now.
Saves it?
I think there's a redemption there because she's actually using that to show, like, to kind of turn it around a little and you know, on that trope. I don't know that it quite – I think I still would have preferred for there to have been something else because that's a completely made-up thing. That's not in the Persephone myth. So I don't know. But I think she does enough with it to make me think, okay, I might let you – because everything else that she's doing.
Well, I'd be interested because I know some people have read along with us. I'm interested to see what they think. And I want to know.
And I mean, it does build up the character of Zeus as being a complete arsehole right from the start.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm – yeah. But it doesn't necessarily motivate her to want to poison his
just
milk.
Again,
or...
It's just a little – well, but that's also an interesting thing because she doesn't go out on this great revenge kick. You know, she's still quite disempowered.
The only reason she runs away is because she knows Zeus is coming for her.
Yeah, that's what I mean. She's you know, it's an interesting
– she's pissed off, don't get me wrong. But
she is. But she's powerless against Zeus.
Yeah.
So it is an interesting use of the thing. It's I was just slightly uncomfortable with the idea of bringing this character in only to have her raped and killed. Which is kind of what happens.
Yeah, okay. Fair point.
Yeah, because she's a character who just comes in for the specific purpose of Persephone falling in love with her and then having this traumatic experience.
Yeah, and also awakening of Persephone's sexuality.
Yeah, yeah. But I did like that ultimately the book did bring Persephone around to thinking outside of herself on this. So that was good.
All right. There's a secondary character who we should probably mention. The dog.
Cerberus.
Yeah, Cerberus.
I love Cerberus.
Yeah, Cerberus is great. I saw
that. That's another thing. It's like.
There was some gifs of little
puppy
Cerberus.
Did you know Cerberus?
Yeah, only from.
Cerberus, you did know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's what I think. When you know the stuff, it's like, oh, there's Cerberus as a puppy.
Yeah, because he's so like cute. the dog of
Hell. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I've seen
like,
that.
Who's this puppy?
Yeah.
But that's what I mean. Like when you're familiar with the original source material, you get this extra friction, to use that word.
But no, there's another character, the one who's
Athena's
ex-lover, whose name I've completely forgotten. I'm sorry. It was so bad. You know what I did like, before we find her name?
Yes.
The fact that the is it Pallas?
Of course, Pallas Athena. Yes. Yes, Pallas.
No, but what was interesting is that when they finally do – spoiler – when they finally do shag, it's a really well-written scene. I thought, considering all the overwrought I thought it was going to be, oh, my God, this is going to be dripping. It's
pun intended.
I didn't mean that one. This is going to be like swimming through treacle. I'm really going to puke. But no, it's really sensitively written. And I thought, you know, shit, that would have been a lot nicer throughout the book. But it doesn't matter. Anyway, I've said my point. I'm not going to belabor it, even though I have. So,
I wanted to say when we were talking about, you know, Anti-Copernicus and you were saying how you didn't think any of the books we read had that level. I think this is what The Dark Wife is doing. I think
it would have, for me, been more intense and more difficult, in air quotes, if it had been shorter.
Yeah, okay. There was a little bit too much in the underworld that could have been a little bit of the toing and froing. But I really, really liked what she was doing with the myths. I loved the fact that she made this such a female book. I mean, all of the significant characters were women.
Yep.
And most of the significant characters were lesbian or bisexual, which is – and actually that was one of the things I wanted to because I was looking at her website and what I was interested in is why she self-published, because I thought this book, with a little bit of massaging, this is a book I could imagine seeing on the shelves. So I was looking at her website, which we'll link to, and I just want to read out this part where she's talking about why she self-published. And she says, so this is Sarah Deemer. I did not self-publish because I didn't think publishers or an agent wouldn't take me. I did not self-publish because I don't believe in the traditional publishing world. I do. I think it has its place. My career plan is to eventually get an agent and a traditional publishing deal and also publish several books through small presses because I think it's a good idea to have a well-rounded writing experience and you can reach more people if you put your work on all paths. The main reason that I self-published is that I know a lot of people think lesbian books don't sell and I wanted to prove that they do. Period. There are many, many people in the publishing world who won't touch gay YA, not because they're homophobic or because they don't like these sort of books, but because they don't think they'll sell. I'm a stubborn and very independent soul, and I love a challenge. I believe that if the story was good, the book solid, and enough marketing was done, the book would sell, and greatly. I also believed to the moon and back that people wanted these stories. They wanted lesbian YA. I knew they wanted it, but knowing something and proving something are two very different things. So simply, I set out, and I proved it. Which I think is a really...
When she says she's proved it, I actually didn't do the good reads on this one. The Dark Wife is actually second to Angelfall in terms of popularity. Now,
there you go.
There is a massive gap.
Well,
but it actually has a rating of 490, 490 people, and a, mm-hmm. an overall rank overall mark of 3.96 out of 5. So it is number two to Angel Falls. So I mean, I think she's obviously done.
Yeah,
and you said she's earning out now or making
well,
money.
Well, I mean, of her writing overall, not just The Dark Wife.
Yeah,
I mean, but her and her wife do write lesbian fiction. That their characters are lesbian characters. It's
well, she says she's proved it. So I'm assuming she's got figures that show.
Well, the book is well. I mean, they're living off their writing. They're full time writers, both of them.
Yeah, okay.
They have another art business that they do as well. But basically, I mean, they're supporting themselves largely from their lesbian fiction. So yeah. I guess she's proved it.
Yeah, no, fair point.
I thought her answer to the question of why she self-published was really good. That she's not saying that this is the only way to go. She's saying, you know, emphasizing that all different avenues of publication have their merits and their downsides, and basically you try to get your work out there in as many arenas as possible. Just based on The Dark Wife, I can't see why she wouldn't get an agent and a publisher at some point in the future.
Yeah, as I said, I'd require a bit more editing, but apart from that, yeah, I agree. I think there's some, as I said, really great stuff in there.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the first
one. Well, I shall read some more of her and I shall report back.
Next month, we're doing the next three,
yes.
Which are Black God's War by Moses Sirigar III, The Silence of Medea by Andrea K. Hirst. That's because it's got the umlauty thing on top, yeah. And Paintwork by Tim Maughan. So they're the three we'll be doing next month.
Yes.
When we say
next
month.
Aren't you glad, listeners, we didn't try to do them all in one go?
Yes. But when we say next month, we mean the next 15 minutes.
Yes, we're going to have a cup of tea.
And possibly a digestive.
Digestive.
Can we finish this one up so we can do the next three?
Please.
Kirsten, go ahead.
Yes, so that's the books we'll be doing in the next episode. So in the meantime, because you guys will have a month, you can send us feedback on the first three books we talked about. You can send that to the website, writerandcritic.podbean.com, and you can leave a comment there. You can email us at writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, and you'll probably get Ian on Twitter if he thinks to answer. And Twitter is writerandcritic, or you can leave us a ratings on iTunes if you liked the podcast.
And a bit like Goodreads, we'd like 5 stars.
This is not true. I've seen a lot of 1 star ratings on Goodreads.
Oh, there's plenty. There was a whole debate about it, wasn't there, about kicking off the 1 star.
Oh, we're not going into that.
I think we've got another hour, so let's do it.
Anywho, so that's the end of the ebook extravaganza part one.
And for those writers we haven't done yet,
you're left on a
Bye.